Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with warnings to Iran from John Bolton, standing next to Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, not to mistake U.S. prudence and discretion for weakness, and examine reports that U.S. Cyber Command has launched cyber attacks against the intelligence arm of the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, targeting their capability to track tankers in the Gulf. A former veteran CIA officer who operated in the Middle East and is now an intelligence and national security affairs analyst for CNN, Robert Baer, joins us to discuss the shocking amateurism of the Trump national security team, now absent a Secretary of Defense, and subject to the whims of an unqualified and indecisive commander-in-chief who often acts on the advice of Fox News hosts or the last person he talked to. With Vice President Pence dutifully doing cleanup for his boss, insisting, as Trump claimed, that rogue elements in Iran were acting independently of the leadership when they shot down the U.S. Global Hawk drone, we will assess whether a country which the U.S. is throttling with economic warfare is on a war footing with the supreme leader and the IRGC fully in control and calling the shots. And since many of the U.S.'s closest allies either do not believe Trump or take him seriously, we'll look into whether escorting tankers with coalition warships, as was done during the tanker wars of 1988, is now a possibility. Then we'll speak with Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations, Mansour Farhang, a professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College. He joins us to discuss whether the hawks running Iran, who Trump has rewarded by pulling out of the nuclear deal, are in any way likely to make a deal with Trump, who has promised to make Iran great again. Trump even thanked the IRGC for not shooting down a U.S. spy plane with 30 on board, and we'll assess whether the supreme leader is capable of exploiting Trump's eagerness to engage in talks, since the regime is able to blame all of Iran's problems on the Americans, not the theocratic kleptocracy they represent. Then finally, we'll examine last week's announcement by Facebook in partnership with Uber, Spotify, PayPal, MasterCard, and Visa that they will lead the effort to create a new global currency, the Libra. Michael Hiltzik, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, who writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, joins us to discuss his latest article at the LA Times, Facebook Currency Plan is a Play for Suckers. We'll look into how Facebook's global currency would break down the wall between banking and commerce, and given the nature of their business model of surveillance capitalism, the dangers inherent in Facebook knowing everything about your account balance and spending. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. Considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East, he is an intelligence and national security affairs analyst for CNN, and his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
It's good to be back.
Well, thanks. And what's the – your? I mean, clearly Mike Pompeo is running U.S. foreign policy, and we have – he's not an absentee president, but I think sort of mentally he's absent because he doesn't know anything and can't make up his mind and takes advice from people like Tucker Carlson, the Fox News host, or the last person he talks to. So it's a pretty extraordinary – situation in your long career in the U.S. government. Have you ever seen a national security team more absent? And mercifully, so far we have not had a crisis. Most presidencies are beset by one crisis or another, like 9/11, for example. So far, we haven't had a crisis. But are we on the brink of one with Iran?
Well, there are two answers to that, and I think one is we should be very thankful that common sense, which doesn't usually happen, sees Trump and said, wait a minute, am I ready to go into World War III? Because that's about what it would look like fighting Iran. And, you know, obviously we do not have the troops to go into a full-fledged war. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of troops you'd have to put in the Gulf, all your aircraft carriers. And they, even at that, they wouldn't be safe. So, you know, I think he sort of got a sense he was being, you know, ghosted into gaslighted into going to war with Iran. By Bolton, who was on the MEK payroll. This is a cult that's killed Americans in the past in Tehran, and they're completely out of their minds, but he did speeches for them. And then you've got Pompeo, who, you know, is talking about the apocalypse. So even Trump has sort of figured this out. And when Fox, Tucker Carlson, said, this is really a dumb idea, you know, it is a dumb idea. But on the other hand, the Iranians see a vulnerable superpower. And what they can keep doing is, now that they know where the red lines are, don't kill any Americans and do what you like. They will gradually exert control over the Gulf. And they'll do that by telling, you know, effectively telegraphing everybody in the world, we are in charge of security in the Gulf. We are in charge of 20% of the world's oil consumption, not the United States. Flailing around in the Gulf with aircraft carriers and boasting and making threats isn't a way to fight Iran. And frankly, they're smarter than we are. This is sort of all they think about, is projecting power. If you like, a second Persian Empire, because they do have the upper hand in Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria, which is a new situation. This isn't the old Iran. I mean, they have taken more parts of the Middle East, you know, going back thousands of years. It's never been like this.
Well, in part, thanks to the blundering of the U.S. and getting involved in Iran, which... The only winner of the Iraq War, of course, was Iran. But since I mentioned in the opening that John Bolton was standing next to Netanyahu when he made that sort of warning to Iran not to misinterpret America's patience for weakness, he's going to be holding talks this week with his Russian and Israeli counterparts, Nikolai Patrushev, Putin's national security advisor, and Maya Ben Shabbat, the Israeli national security advisor. And apparently they're going to be talking about what to do about Iranian influence in Syria, particularly the IRGC's Quds force. Do you think there's a deal in the making there, that Israel has enough leverage to say, you know, either you, the Russians, get them out of Syria, or we're going to, you know, bomb the hell out of them? What do you think are there any contours of a deal there?
None at all. I mean, what's holding Bashar al-Assad in power is Iran and Hezbollah. You know, a couple of years ago, I drove into Syria and looked across at the military road, which runs parallel to the main highway, and there were all sorts of equipment going back and forth and people, and I asked my host, I said, who is that? And he said, that's Hezbollah. I mean, the fact is that there is no real Syrian army. There are Alawite militias. And then there's Hezbollah. And that, frankly, they took back most of these cities. And they're absolutely crucial for Syria's, for the regime's security. So they're not going to give them up. They can give up the Russian Air Force in a heartbeat. And that's all the Russians really have there, but not Hezbollah. So, you know, call it what you want, but what we have is the Shia Crescent, and every single minister in Iraq, in one way or another, is under the thumb of the Iranians. This is just a fact. I mean, you know, frankly, they just scratched their heads in 2003. We invaded without a plan and effectively turned the government over to the Shia in Iraq, which one way or another are beholden to Tehran. I mean, everybody there, including the prime minister, is on the Iranian payroll. So So, you know, however this Iranian empire came about, it still exists. And now all the Iranians have to do is get us out of the Gulf by attacking tankers or by continuing this war in Yemen, attacking desalinization plants, as they did the other day in Saudi Arabia. And they've got the upper hand. And you have an administration, Trump, who doesn't read, doesn't understand Iran, doesn't remember our long history with the Iranians of, you know, shooting down the Airbus and Pan Am 103 and on and on and on, the Marines. And he just thinks that he can threaten them with, a good drubbing from the air and they'll give up. That's not the way that country works. As we've talked about, a lot of those people believe in the apocalypse, their own apocalypse. The 12th Imam is going to return one day. And Ahmadinejad used to drop post-its down the well where he's supposedly, Jamkaran well, which he's supposedly at the bottom of. So these people are ready to fight to the end. And they don't care if we bomb their tanks and their airfields because they depend on asymmetrical warfare. And, you know, any sort of intervention in Iran risks an immediate escalation within hours, and that would involve the Iranians rocketing Saudi and Emirati oil facilities and closing the Strait of Hormuz, which would send the world's economy into a nosedive. You just can't take off 20% of the world's oil consumption and not expect a disaster.
So the plan, back to the talks between Bolton and Patrushev and Maya Ben Shabbat next week, supposedly the Russians expect the U.S. to recognize Assad's regime in Syria and lift the sanctions, and in exchange Russia would either reduce the Iranian presence or drive Iran out of Syria, and that you've made clear is not going to happen. Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Korea Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. Considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East, he is an intelligence and national security affairs analyst for CNN, and his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassination. So the symmetry is there between our hawks and theirs, and it's even worse than that because we have a Secretary of State who's pretty much running point on all of this. I don't think Bolton has a lot of clout with Trump, but Pompeo does. There's no Secretary of Defense. He has no rivals. He believes in the rapture, and the Supreme Leader believes in the return of the 12th Imam. So that is a scary prospect in itself. Pompeo, of course, was Gina Haspel's. She was his deputy when he was at the CIA. And Mark Esper was Pompeo's classmate at West Point. He's going to be the new Secretary of Defense. So do you think Pompeo, being a bureaucratic infighter, do you think he can con Trump into going to war? Because it's only Trump's promise, as he pointed out, to his campaign promise that he wants to get the U.S. out of the Middle East, not to get in any more of these stupid wars, that's stopping World War III, as you pointed out, Robert Baer. Do you think Pompeo can sway Trump to do, you know, to pull the trigger?
I don't think he has to. If, you know, looking at, you know, the world through his POV, what you do is simply wait for the Iranians to continue and wait for some accident to occur in the Gulf, whether one of our ships gets fired on or we fire on one of theirs, it gets too close. You keep the pressure on Iran, and eventually there will be some sort of escalation, which will put Trump in a corner. So what Pompeo wants to do is put Iran in a corner and Trump, and you're almost guaranteed to have a war. I mean, can Putin talk Trump? I mean, Putin now at this point, as much as I can read the guy, is worried about World War III in the Gulf. You know, we've talked about this, how he would benefit from higher prices of oil. But on the other hand, a general conflict in the Middle East is to no one's benefit. But I think at the end of the day, you know, we've entered the logic of war. It may not be for several months, but I just don't see this president, as crazy as he is, coming to some grand bargain with the Iranians, just as he hasn't with North Korea.
In spite of the excellent letter that Kim said he got from Trump, these love letters are just extraordinary. But there's no way in the world that you can make a comparison. I've talked to Iranian specialists about this, between North Korea and Iran. Obviously, Trump would like to have an opening with Iran, just like he thinks he has with North Korea, have a great photo opportunity with the Supreme Leader. But since the U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA, the P5+1, everything's played right into the Supreme Leader's hands. He's loving it. The IRGC are loving it. They're back in the saddle, aren't they?
Well, I mean, look at it from the Iranians' perspective. I mean, would you trust the United States? They invaded a neighbor for no good reason at all. Then there's this hard-fought, very reasonable nuclear agreement, which kept Iran from getting a bomb and their intrusive inspections. And then for no reason at all, the United States pulls out. And then, I mean, yesterday Trump's talking about, well, I have stopped him from getting a nuclear bomb. Well, the 2015 agreement did exactly that. And there's no dispute about that.
So what do you think Trump is talking about when he says on Monday he's going to impose major additional sanctions?
Well, what he's going to do is punish the Europeans, which isn't very conducive to, you know, forming a coalition to fight Iran. You're just going to see that just generally American foreign policy is auguring in our credibility and everything else. I mean, think about the George H.W. Bush's first Gulf War after the invasion of Kuwait. You know, that just sort of went like clockwork because people had faith in us. They had faith in our intelligence. They had faith in our plan. And in fact, we didn't go all the way to Baghdad, which was a smart decision. But that, you know, we are so far from that administration. We had James Baker, knew what he was doing, and now you have a Secretary of State who's an apocalyptic Christian. It's night and day.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, what are we to make of Cyber Command having launched a retaliatory strike against the IRGC spy? And apparently the IRGC, they're trying to cripple the IRGC's ability to find out what tankers are moving in and out of the Gulf, and which would suggest that they actually deliberately targeted that Japanese tanker.
Oh, of course they did. I mean, the same day that the Japanese prime minister is meeting in Tehran, they basically said, and the Iranians are really, really smart. They basically said, you can take this message and you know what to do with it. Told Japanese that.
Right. They humiliated him, you know, right on camera. You can see Abe was totally humiliated.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, why we let the far right call the tune on Iran and have all this years. I mean, they're not nice guys. They killed many of my colleagues, friends of mine. But they're smart and they're calculating, and they know a lot about maintaining their existence and their survival. Because they're not like the Islamic State, that they're going to do something stupid and get wiped off the map.
Well,
they're playing chess, and we're playing, I don't know what we're playing, tic-tac-toe.
Cowboys and Indians. I thank you for joining us, Robert Baer.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is an intelligence and national security affairs analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the Iranians will take up Trump on his promise to make Iran great again.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against Lamb and my hero.
have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mansour Farhang, who is a professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendations to release its U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, the Spanish American War to the Iranian Revolution, and the U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mansour Farhang. Well, thanks for joining us, Mansour. And I take it you are equally suspicious that I am about the possibility of the Supreme Leader taking up President Trump's promise to make Iran great again. Aren't the Supreme Leader and the IRGC enjoying this situation? They're back in the saddle since the Iran deal was canceled. Now that the country's under economic warfare from the United States, under threat, under siege, if you will, doesn't that put them back in control? If they not that they're ever out of control, but there were some pressures from the sort of secular majority, I wouldn't say secular majority, but from the people who are fed up with this kleptocratic theocracy.
Yeah. There is no question with respect to internal Iranian political situation, just as the Bush administration, by overthrowing Saddam Hussein, gave a fantastic historical gift to Iran's theocrats. President Trump, his maximum pressure is another gift to Iran, to Iran's, I would say, the most radical elements within Iranian theocracy, because it virtually unifies the country against American pressure and makes it actually a laughable idea for Trump to expect Ayatollah Khamenei to join him as if he's president of North Korea. Maybe he might fall in love with him and all that, but that's really childish. And what I can say about it is that there is no one in the national security apparatus of the White House who knows anything about it. I've talked to a number of people who are very knowledgeable, who have been in the policymaking position. The only person who has been talking about Iran for decades is John Bolton, and his connection with Iran is with the cultist group, whose members actually supported Saddam Hussein in the war against Iran. It shows the absurdity of how uneducated, how ignorant the Trump administration is about Iran.
Well, the other piece of absurdity was that the president thanked the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps for not shooting down a U.S. spy plane with 30 on board. How often does that happen? It's amazing.
It's really amazing. You know, the President Trump's approach to Iran is not a policy with realistic goal. It is a pressure tactic to force Iran to capitulate. And anyone who has some elementary knowledge and understanding of the Iranian regime and those who rule it could tell him that this is an illusion. They are not going to submit to him. In other words, the right now, the confrontation between Iran and the United States has reached the point that only a negotiated settlement or war can end it. and negotiate a settlement, in my opinion, because the Iranian regime, in spite of its rhetoric and ideological claims, is first and foremost interested in its own survival. But right now, these sanctions have made it extremely difficult for Iran with respect to the general public and within the Iranian society as well as the economy, because the state really runs, you know, the economy. However, this is not going to force them. In fact, the government-related, the state-oriented actors, they know how to go around the sanctions. They have been doing it for 4 years. The general public will suffer. There is no question about it. And at the same time, I think they will be ready to negotiate if Trump is willing to suspend the sanctions at least for a given period of time, so the Iranians can say, we accomplished something. Our resistance resulted in Trump backing off at this for a short period of time. That could pave the way for a negotiated settlement and prevent a war, which would be a regional war and incredibly devastating to the Iranian society as well as other countries in the region.
So our previous guest, former CIA officer Robert Baer, I don't know whether you ever saw the movie Syriana. George Clooney played him in that movie, based on a book of his called See No Evil. He was pointing out what's even scarier than this counterintuitive pressure campaign to make the Iranians cry uncle, and the reverse is happening. They're rallying around the flag and hunkering down, and that they using asymmetrical warfare, which they're expert at, they're just going to keep taunting us and pricking us. But he pointed out something further, which is that you have this apocalyptic nature of the supreme leader's belief system in the 12th Imam, returning the Messiah. And then you've got Mike Pompeo, the former Tea Party congressman. His political career has been funded by the Koch brothers. He is one of those Christians, so-called Christians, who believe in the rapture. So does that worry you, that you've got that symbiosis? Because it's bad enough having bad geopolitics. But when you inject religious messianic elements, then it's really out in loony land.
You see, if that kind of messianic rhetoric, even regardless of if its absurdity with respect to logic and so forth, it also involves a degree of ethics and of belief in some kind of morality and all that. While in the Iran, it's one of the most corrupt societies in the region. And in fact, the regime, in the name of messianic rapture over the past 4 years, they have created a new ruling class. And the division of wealth and income in Iran is worse than ever before. Ayatollah Khamenei, the so-called who represents the hidden imam, he is a billionaire. His family and all the people close to him, and it's a deeply family-oriented regime. So it may well be that in the process of struggling to gain power, they use that kind of rhetoric, they could even believe in it, that for populistic purposes, to gain popular support, their religious, you know, prejudices and beliefs in the society, particularly in the traditional sectors of the society, they use it. But in the position of power, they go through transformation. They go through a dramatic change, and we are seeing this in Iran, as we saw it in other countries that came to power claiming ideological purity, but in the position of power, they turned out to be something different. When the Soviet Union collapsed, a country that for 70 years denied there was private ownership at all, after collapse of the Soviet Union, there were more billionaires in Russia than in the United States. This is similar situation in Iran. That no, I'm not at all, I'm worried about the confrontation between men of power in Iran and Trump's irrational policy leading to war, and the victims of the war will be the Iranian people. What is happening in Iran, what the Iran is doing, is that that is sanctions. And sanctions can hurt. And they can hurt the general public, but the state-affiliated actors are experienced in using the black market to circumvent the restrictions, as they have been doing for the past 4 years. What they are doing right now, in response to maximum pressure policy of the Trump administration, Iran seems to have decided to pressure Trump and his regional allies in return by making commercial shipping in the Persian Gulf insecure. Not only Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Oman, all of these countries desperately need freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf with respect to export of oil, but also countries, European countries, Japan, South Korea, India, China, among others, they all depend on that. So Iran is playing this card in order to create problem for Trump and his allies in the region. So they are really playing a power-oriented game, just as when it comes to their relationship with Russia, China, and India, they are playing ordinary games in international politics. They pay absolutely when Chinese, for example, decimate the Muslims. You never hear a critical word about Iran. But Trump, what the Russians did to Muslims in Chechnya, you never heard a critical word about that in Iran. But when something happens, for example, in Palestine, suddenly they have this responsibility to defend them. Now, these are men of power, and they have created a regime that their interest and continuation of the control of the society dominates their positions.
And again, I'm speaking with Mansour Farang, who's Professor Emeritus of International Relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendations to release its U.S. hostages. And his books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. But my understanding, though, is, Mansour, that the hardliners were the reason that they agreed to the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal, in part, was because they were feeling some pressure from their own people. They were under sanctions. I don't think the sanctions they were under are even as bad as what they have now. But one of the things that happened as a result of the JCPOA, which to my mind indicates that was what the idea was to essentially, it's the same thing with the TPP. It was more than a trade agreement. It was really a geopolitical agreement to try and force China to play by the rules and organize the neighborhood against it. Trump canceled the TPP very quickly when he canceled the Paris Climate Accords. Apparently, Trump actually thought China was in the TPP, which is the opposite of what it was. That shows you the dangerous ignorance of this man. But wasn't it true that some of the consequences of the JCPOA was that the Iranian people found out for the first time how much money the mullahs were creaming off the top?
Absolutely. In fact, at the same time, the regime at the time, there was a factional division within the regime, precisely because President Obama didn't talk about regime change in Iran, did not question the legitimacy of the regime. From the time he was campaigning, he focused on Iran's nuclear issue, which was the concern of Europe, and he ended up going to the Security Council and getting 6 resolutions against Iran in order to contain Iran's nuclear program, resolutions that China and Russia also voted for it. And therefore, the regime reached the point that they could no longer blame the Obama administration for the economic hardship in the country and this division within the regime, the factional division that definitely, undoubtedly, there were elements within the regime who were very much committed to the theocracy, but they wanted to normalize their commercial relations, their financial relations with the Western world. There is no question about that, because this, the Islamic Republic of Iran doesn't have any problem with imperialism in an economic sense. Their hostility toward the West is largely cultural. As Khomeini said, he was more concerned with the short skirt of women than with the economic or military power of the United States. It might be an exaggerated statement, but it reveals the mindset of the reactionary people who is fundamentally against modernity in a social cultural sense. Otherwise, when it comes to economic issues, when it comes to investment, they are very much committed to the capitalist system, and they wouldn't have any problem with the United States. So they accepted the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, and they actually lived up to their obligations. International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as intelligence agencies of the United States and Europe, even Israel, they all said Iran has lived up to it. And yet, Trump comes in and rejects the idea, which didn't make any sense to anybody. Right now, if Trump suspends the sanctions for a short period of time, there could be serious movement toward negotiation. That is mediation. The European countries are trying to mediate the situation, but it's extremely difficult for Iran, for after 40 years of taking a position, making anti-Americanism part of their identity, suddenly is standing next to Trump when Trump has rejected the nuclear deal. So I would say the Iranian regime has both an ideological side, which is useful to it with respect to domestic audience, and also their supporters in the region, particularly Shi'i groups, who have always been somewhat discriminated against in various Arab countries. It also has a very pragmatic, capitalist-oriented side. And there are so many examples to show that these people are not really interested in economic justice or fairness. They're interested in survival of their own regime and also the enrichment of the capital, of the class they have created. In other words, they really do have a great deal in common with someone like Trump. If Trump was willing to negotiate with them instead of pressuring them in such a way that they would not be able to accept it.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Bolton, of course, the National Security Advisor, was standing next to Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel when he warned Iran not to mistake U.S. prudence and discretion for weakness. And then Bolton is on his way this week to meet with Nikolai Patrushev, who's Putin's national security advisor, and Maya Ben Shabat, who's the Israeli national security advisor. And the three of them are supposedly working on a deal where Russia is hoping that the U.S. will recognize the regime of Bashar al-Assad and lift sanctions in exchange that Russia would either reduce Iranian presence in Syria or get Iran to withdraw from Syria. Our previous guest, the former CIA officer Robert Baer, thought that was very, very unrealistic, and there's no way in the world that Iran's going to give up Hezbollah. What do you think of that deal, or that deal in the making?
If they can persuade the Syrian government to contain Iran's access to Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, because Iran's access to sending military aid, assisting them, it's largely through Syria. If Syria can be rewarded for containing Iran, they will not completely eliminate the presence of Iran in Syria, but they could significantly contain its influence. Otherwise, Hezbollah is already part of the government in Lebanon. They have a significant presence in the parliament of Lebanon, and they also have very close relationship to Iran. That relationship will continue, but the ability of Iran to assist the Hezbollah economically and militarily, that could be contained if Russia and the United States and Syria could agree on the kind of arrangement that the reconstruction of Syria can receive some international aid directly or indirectly with the participation of the United States. because Iran, it definitely has a presence in Syria, but Iran does not have the economic capability for reconstruction of Syria. Syria is a ruined country, a country where half of the people were displaced. Millions of people are homeless. The country is completely destroyed. They are talking about the need for over $300 billion to begin the reconstruction of Syria. Iran is not in the position to participate in that. If Syria could be persuaded that international community could help in this regard, in exchange, Bashar Assad would be willing to contain Iran's presence in Syria.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute, what do you think of the going on with Putin? There have been some reports that Putin's worried that Trump is going to blunder into World War III in the Gulf. There's another school of thought that says, well, if the Straits of Hormuz are closed down, oil prices will go through the ceiling and Russia will be one of the main beneficiaries of high oil prices. Where do you come down on that?
I think what Putin wants, he wants the animosity between the United States and Iran to continue, because he will be the beneficiary as the exporter of oil. And once the animosity goes on, Iran becomes dependent on Russia, as it has already become dependent. The first place when Iranian foreign minister went in order to gain some assistance with respect to his response to Trump was Russia. So Russia is not in the position of Iran needs foreign investment. Iran needs open trade. It's Western Europe and the United States that Iran is desperately trying to establish normal relationship. Russia is a competitor of Iran as an exporter of oil. And what Putin wants is he doesn't want war, but he wants continuation of confrontation and animosity between Tehran and Washington, because it serves his interests and his ambitions in the region.
Well, Mansour Farang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mansour Farang, who is a professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendations to release its U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press and Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back discussing the dangers inherent in Facebook's global currency. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing the corruption in the entertainment business, and he currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues relevant to life in California. His books include Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Facebook Currency Plan is a Play for Suckers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzik.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be back with you.
Well, thanks, Michael. And I get absolutely, overwhelmed by spam from Russia along with trolling you have to wade through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails to find any email from a real listener, and it's really tiresome. And a lot of what I get on a daily basis is pitches for Bitcoin scams, and they've also lately been getting threats saying that they'll expose all of my private information, whatever that's worth, and I have to pay them so much money in Bitcoin, and they give you a number for a Bitcoin wallet to deposit money. As of June the 1st, you'll lose everything, that kind of stuff. So my sense is that Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, is just a bad thing to begin with. So the idea that Facebook wants to jump in on this just seems horrendous. So am I right in being suspicious about cryptocurrency, feeling that it's somehow a part of the dark web and an enabler for criminality?
Sure. Well, there are a number of reasons to be suspicious about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Basically, they haven't shown yet that they can be consistent storehouses of value or that they can maintain a rational price. So they're not very useful for legitimate businesses or legitimate investors. They really are sort of a more of an ideology than a useful asset class at this point. There are any number of people out there who say, well, the importance of things like Bitcoin isn't in the Bitcoin itself, but in the underlying technology, which is known as the blockchain, and is designed so that you don't need a single centralized authority to manage the currency, like a central bank or even a network of commercial banks. It's all sort of done in the cloud through computer algorithms, and this is supposed to be a great advance over national sovereign currencies. The jury is still way out on this. There's been no showing that this really is as useful as its proponents say. And what Facebook seems to be trying to do is bootstrap the image of Bitcoin as something new and clever to the same old goal that it's always had of making money by providing a service that really ends up exploiting people's inattention to their own privacy. And that's where we are with this Facebook cryptocurrency, which it's dubbed Libra.
Well, just to add to the blockchain, this computing power and these algorithms require as much electricity as a major city. So it's not exactly global warming friendly. But what about the notion, though, Michael Hiltzig, that the Facebook global currency would break down the wall between banking and commerce, and given the nature of their business model of surveillance capitalism, the dangers inherent in Facebook knowing everything about your account balance and your spending habits would just seem to me to be quite unbelievably pernicious.
Well, I can't disagree with you. In fact, the headline on my column over the weekend was, "You don't trust Facebook to protect your privacy. Why would you trust it to be your banker?" Essentially, that's a very good question. Facebook has had to acknowledge that its reputation for protecting people's privacy is really in the toilet at this point. Essentially, for privacy advocates and increasingly for its own users, its name is mud. It consistently violates people's privacy. It misuses their data. It gets caught over and over again, and then says, well, we made a mistake. We didn't know, this was an unintended consequence. We will do better next time. So I don't think they really do have a trustworthy reputation. And because of that, in proposing this new cryptocurrency, they've taken steps that they say would seal it off from the privacy concerns that people have about Facebook. They've created a subsidiary that would manage people's buying and selling of Libra and their holding of Libra. They call it Calibra. they say that Calibre will have no ability to transmit its customers or its users' private information to Facebook itself unless the customers deliberately opt in, that is, that they explicitly give Calibre permission to pass their information on to Facebook. Now, that's a pretty good pledge. The problem is that Facebook has pledged similar promises many times, and often what's happened is that users wake up in the morning and they discover that their settings have been changed to allow privacy invasions that they did not actually know they were allowing because Facebook has done something with its software or its algorithm that's changed people's permissions. So we don't know whether the same problem would occur with Calibre. As a very smart commentator in the Financial Times, the British financial newspaper, pointed out, if you become a customer of Calibre and you are offered a form that says, yes, I consent to Calibre passing my information on to Facebook, you're going to be offered a lot of incentives to check that box and allow it to happen. Maybe you'll get a break on fees. Maybe you'll get some sort of blandishment. But you're going to be encouraged one way or another for Calibre and Facebook to work more closely together on your account, and it's something that I think users would have to be very, very wary about and guard against.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing the corruption in the entertainment business, and he's currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. His books include Colossus, Hoover Dam, and The Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Facebook's Currency Plan is a Play for Suckers. So let's talk about this partnership that Facebook has formed with Uber, Spotify, PayPal, MasterCard, Visa, and others. What is the plan? Is it like that, I can't remember the name of it now, but that sort of internet thing, Groupon, what's it called, where, you know, you can get discounts at restaurants? I mean, what are they promising? Why have all these others come aboard, particularly credit card companies?
Well, it's actually hard to say. Facebook isn't very clear about what these partners will get out of the arrangement, and the idea is the partners put up $10 million to help fund this whole new currency arrangement and then get their name on it. It's really not very clear what they get out of it, except that one can presume that they think that being in on the ground floor of this won't be a bad thing for them. It'll be a good thing. And, of course, as you point out, or, you know, the companies you've named, I mean, we're talking about MasterCard and Visa. We're talking about a lot of Silicon Valley venture funds. We're talking about Uber. A lot of these enterprises don't inspire a lot more trust in the public than Facebook does. So it's a little unclear what guarantees or what assurances it's trying to offer the public by saying, you know, we're not in this alone. We've got all these other businesses and firms in with us. There's a lot about Libra that's still very unclear. In fact, Facebook says, you know, we're going to be working on a lot of these aspects before we roll out the currency, probably sometime in 2020. In fact, one thing that's unclear is whether this really is a cryptocurrency in the sense that Bitcoin is, and even whether it needs to be, whether it needs to have this blockchain technology. There's no evidence in the white paper that Facebook put out that it really is going to use this technology or that it needs to. That's one of the many uncertainties that's still out there.
Well, but they've said that they're going to create a very stable currency globally, in spite of the fact that, you know, how do you think George Soros became a billionaire? trading in currency. I mean, that
depends on what you mean by stable. What Facebook says is that Libra will be backed by a basket of major currencies, and we can presume that includes the U.S. dollar, the pound sterling, the Swiss franc, the euro, maybe one or two other hard currencies out there. And the idea is that when you put that basket together, it's going to have a discernible value, and Libra will be pegged to that value. But since all those currencies fluctuate against each other, if you are an actual user of Libra and you do most of your business in any one of those currencies, it's not going to be necessarily stable. It's going to fluctuate. If you're in the United States and you do most of your transactions in dollars, but you use Libra for one reason or another, you really have no way of knowing that the value of Libra is going to be stable against the U.S. dollar. It'll be stable against that basket, but the basket isn't stable. So this is another uncertainty that people have looked at and said, what does this really mean in Facebook's terms?
But the wall between banking and commerce has been upheld by the Congress, and it's pretty logical when you think about it. You don't want banks competing with your own customers. In other words, when you deposit a check from your business, you don't want the bank finding out who the customer was, and then stealing your best client. I mean, isn't that pretty logical?
Well, it is logical, and once again, one of the interesting things about this Libra rollout or this Libra white paper or the Libra association that Facebook says it's put together is that what you don't see in that association are banks. They're not participating at this point. You also don't see big companies with a lot of transactions under their name, like Google or Amazon. They're not participating either. So once again, what Facebook really is up to is very, very unclear, except that it clearly does hope that somehow Libra will become a widely used currency, and it will find a way to extract fees and profits from that.
So do you think then, just in closing here, do you think that this is just a play by Facebook because they've been some, I don't know how many people are leaving them. I mean, there's been a reaction to their abuse of privacy, people, cutting bait or weaning themselves from the drug of social media. Is there any evidence that's happening? I believe, maybe they've lost 20% of their customers. I'm not sure. But
I'm not sure if Facebook sees this as an alternative business plan. I think what it is trying to do is get into a business that already exists, and that is the pay transmission business. This is something that PayPal was founded on, that MasterCard and Visa, obviously, that's their business. It's a lucrative business because there are a lot of hidden fees involved, fees of merchants, fees charged to users one way or another, that sort of thing. So it may well be, or it may only be, that Facebook wants a piece of that action. To me, it's unclear whether this thing is even going to take off, whether it's got real prospects. Facebook has something in the neighborhood of 2 billion users. So I think its pitch is, this is a big market, and if we can give these users a new way to pay for things and services, that's sort of a captive audience. But I don't know if that's going to take them very far in the short, medium, or long run.
Well, Michael Hertzog, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, happy to do it.
Thank you, Michael. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing the corruption in the entertainment industry, and he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal in Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Facebook Currency Plan is a Play for Suckers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.